Well, welcome to our deep dive on building companies with strong fundamentals, which is all in vogue now, but it's always been a focus of Tidemark and the companies that we work with. In our last session, we talked to Nick Mehta, CEO of Gainsight. When you start hitting a wall as a growth company where things aren't working, you have to pause, slow down, create enough time and profit to reinvest and build that next S-curve of growth. But what happens if you're actually in your S-curve and the market changes and, God forbid, the stock market drops 60, 70%? Pretty relevant discussion for today. What happens? Can you still lean forward? And so what we wanted to do today is walk through a case study with Scott Dorsey, co-founder of ExactTarget. That's exactly what Scott did in 2008, 2009 when the sky was falling. That's the last time the sky fell. Scott is the co-founder of ExactTarget. ExactTarget was my first lead deal at my prior firm. Scott was nice enough to invite me on his board and take a chance with me, so I'm forever grateful. I was on the board at ExactTarget when we were private. My prior firm was the largest investor. Saw it through to the IPO in the growth of the business where ultimately Scott and team sold it to Salesforce. At the time, ExactTarget was the largest SaaS IPO in the history of the industry. Incredibly impressive. The company, just as importantly, grew from founding to 100 million to ultimately close to half a billion AR before selling it to Salesforce. And then when Salesforce bought ExactTarget, also set the standard. It was the largest acquisition that Salesforce had ever done. And my understanding is within Salesforce, it's doing billions in ARR. So let's tee up this discussion and let me bring it to focus. So Scott, you built ExactTarget from its very early days. In the beginning, from zero to call it roughly 50 million ARR, you only really raised 6 million primary capital. And then phase two, you ultimately raised hundreds of millions to grow it to 400 ARR. Tell us about the ExactTarget story in phase one and just in the founding. Like what we miss here? Tell us about your experience building ExactTarget.
Thanks, Dave. Wonderful to be reconnected. Still an honor for me, by the way, to have the first deal you've ever led in the venture industry be ExactTarget. So that one worked out really well for both of us. And you were an incredible partner and investor and grateful for the friendship we've had over the years. So let's turn back the clock here a little bit. So we started ExactTarget, I'd say two financial crises ago in late 2000, early 2001, three first-time software entrepreneurs. And we had a vision around bringing marketing online and leveraging the principles of database marketing and personalization and doing so through digital marketing. And fortunately, we kind of latched on to a really big idea, but it certainly was a challenging time to start a software company, very akin to where we are today. So, and we were very, very scrappy. To your point, Dave, we were super, super frugal and capital efficient to such an extent that the three of us who started ExactTarget, you know, we worked without a salary for the first year. We raised money from friends and family. We were very, very frugal and creative, you know, and one of the opportunities that economic downturns present is that you have to be really creative and really, really resourceful. And that was us to a T. I'll give you a couple quick examples. Many of our friends had worked for dot-coms and got laid off. They were out of work. We were very small. We weren't in a financial position to hire them. So we created an independent sales agent program where we gave them equity in ExactTarget, 25% commission on anything they would prospect, sell, implement, but we couldn't pay them any base salary. And it was kind of promised that if we turned into a real company, we'd hire them. Well, that worked out brilliantly. By the time we became a funded company, we had a sales team of 15 or 20 reps, you know, trained, enabled, kind of ready to go. But to your point, chapter one, we scaled all the way up to about 70, 72 in GAAP revenue on only 6 million of primary capital. And we still had 4 or 5 million on the balance sheet. So that was, I think, an unprecedented level of frugality and capital efficiency that I haven't been a part of since.
All right. So you're super frugal and crafty in the first tech recession. Then you go to the global financial crisis. It's 2008, 2009. Knives are falling again. You're a profitable business. You know, I kind of remember the numbers, 72 on the nose. I remember it was in our memo. And so you're in 2008, 2009, you've historically been super frugal and crafty, and then you decide to do something different. So explain that, Scott.
Yeah, Dave, and I'll take you in a half step back. So we actually filed to go public in December of 07. And that was a time when kind of smaller SaaS companies were being very well received in the public market. So mid-December 07, filed to go public. Yeah, our GAAP revenue that year was 48. And then you're at the next year of 72. So we're growing at 50%. And we were profitable. We were cash flow positive and profitable. And all of a sudden, the financial crisis hit in 08. And it was miserable. It was really, really difficult. And early 09 presented an opportunity to bring an outside investment. And that really became a time where all of a sudden we could think about scale. We had fresh capital and we were really moving up market. We started out early days selling to small, medium-sized businesses, and then really over time discovered that we had a technology platform that could cater to the large e-commerce and financial services and retail organizations. And it became a really opportune time to hit the gas when everybody was pulling back.
Yeah, and maybe to put it in context, we're not talking about just inching forward. I mean, you went from, I think it was 15 in EBITDA to something very negative at scale. So all with incredible thought and precision and execution, but it was a big bet. So walk me through the thought process. Where'd the initial idea around doubling down or tripling down come from? How'd you get conviction?
Yeah, it was interesting, Dave. I think it took a lot of courage from our leadership team and our board, you know, and investors like you to say, let's kind of zig when everybody else is zagging, and to really lean in on aggressive growth at a time when it felt like the economy was kind of falling apart around us. I would say it started with a belief that we were starting to emerge as a category leader. We were winning larger deals in the market. Our clients were very happy and successful. Renewal rates were high and those accounts were growing and expanding. This was before, you know, NRR became the North Star that it is today, but essentially we had very high NRR. Our customers were not only renewing, but they were growing with us. And then we started to get smarter and smarter on the unit economics of our sales team. How do we hire effectively, ramp productivity? How does productivity grow with sales rep tenure? And we started to really get our arms around the unit economics of the business and have a vision for how we could grow even faster if we invested more in R&D, innovation, expanding internationally, starting to think about M&A. But I think it all came back to a good understanding of our unit economics, having a feeling that we're starting to win in the market, having an incredibly strong culture where we had a team that was locked in and aligned around working hard and working for one another and building something special. And then as we got into financial modeling, Dave, and you might remember this, it was really interesting. We started, instead of planning 1 year at a time, we started looking out over a 3 and 5 year horizon, and we started mapping what would our growth rate look like if we grew our sales team by 10 or 20% each year. That was kind of the natural place to start. And then we started asking ourselves, what if we doubled the sales team over the next year, over the next 2 years? And we started getting smarter about our unit economics and how long it takes to ramp a rep and how their productivity really kicks in a meaningful way, perhaps at month 12, 18, and 24. Also, the backdrop was our competitors were doing the opposite. Sequoia sent out their kind of, you know, famous PowerPoint deck of, you know, rest in peace, good times, and venture-backed companies were being instructed, if not mandated, to reduce headcount and slow hiring. And we ended up doing the opposite. And we felt that if we executed, we could create a lot of separation between us and our competitive set. And thankfully, that's really what happened.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I remember when we first proposed the deal internally, and, you know, I was up there pitching my IC, and I think your two biggest comps, Omniture and I think it was Constant Contact at the time, with their cores, they're down 20%, 15, 20% that day. So it was pretty gnarly. So let's unpack this in a couple different ways. So first, macro bad, exact target good. Growing fast, customers renewing, so on and so forth. And I think this is really important in 2022. There will eventually be a dispersion. How did you know in your gut that exact target would not only be different, but exceed the over macro? How'd you know that the exact target micro wouldn't follow the overall macro?
I think it starts with understanding your value proposition and how you're impacting the business of your customers. And I used to always describe exact target that we had bi-directional ROI. We could help our clients increase revenue, but we could also lower their costs. We could lower their marketing expenses because digital was so efficient. And I think it's important when you head into a time like we're experiencing now where there's real economic headwinds, you have to shift the narrative. So in today's environment, for example, saving on the expense line is probably more important than growing top line. And SaaS platforms have to be sharp enough to know their value prop, know their ROI, but I think really make sure it's tuned in to the economic environment in which you're operating. 2 years ago, it was all about growth, all about growth. Now the platforms that are about efficiency and saving organizations money, those are the ones that are having their moment. And with ExactTarget, we felt like we could shift the ROI message and still be able to deliver a lot of value. That was imperative. I'd say the second component is knowing how woven in you are to your customer's business. Are you really integrated into their business processes? Are you hard to take out? You know, are you integrated into other systems that are part of their day-to-day, week-to-week work? And if you're not, you become really expendable. That gave us confidence, you know, that we had staying power and we could build these long-term relationships with our clients.
And Scott, as the CEO, you're in some ways removed from the customer in the day-to-day operations. And ExactTarget wasn't a small company at that point. Were there certain tactics that you used to make sure you really understood the customer perspective on this new changing narrative? Because it's a big bet, right? If you get that bet wrong and your value prop isn't aligned to efficiency as much as you'd like it to be, then you have a very different result.
Yeah, you know, I think you have to look for signals in all directions. You know, Dave, it's customer advisory board meetings, it's one-on-one meetings with customers, it's really understanding your renewal data, how are your accounts growing, and then really pushing the product team, the engineering team, to make sure that we're building more integration capability and we're really thinking about the work process of our customers and making sure we become an embedded component. That was really, really important. If you lose an account, really understanding why. I'd say we'd really dig deep into losses, both on the new and existing customer front. And there are always amazing insights we could learn from there as well.
One thing that you mentioned is just a culture and an organization that is aligned to execution, predictable execution. And you had that in spades. We knew each other 3 years before I invested, and I think you hit every single forward projection you gave me. You're the only CEO that would give me forward projection. You hit them all. So that's table stakes. But then execution in a changing environment is also quite challenging, right? Because things that worked in the past may not work in a different environment. So how do you calibrate your predictability of execution in this rapidly changing environment?
I think back, we ran ExactTarget for 13 years, which was 52 quarters. And, you know, I think we only missed a couple along the way, thankfully. So I think we were very good at forecasting and then maniacal about hitting, you know, about hitting our numbers and high performance. And we were very, very competitive. So we really worked hard at ExactTarget to build this culture that was both kind, genuine. You know, we really tried to hire nice people. Our number one core value was treat people well. But that could also get mistaken for not being hyper-competitive and very driven and very ambitious. And we really worked to try to bring those two together in a special way. And I never wanted to disappoint our board or our investors, nor our employees. So any goal we set, we'd work day and night to make sure that we achieved it, whether we were in good economic times or bad. And we also had kind of a no excuses, you know, mantra. We weren't going to let the dot-com bubble, 9/11, the financial crisis. We just weren't going to let outside factors serve as an excuse for lack of performance or lack of execution. So we really tried to carry that with us as well.
That's a great segue, Scott. How do you get this board of investors? How'd you get this group there?
It's a good question. I should ask you, Dave, from your perspective also. Maybe I'll go first and then you can share. I think it started with trust. You know, I think it's really important that you build one-on-one friendships, relationships that are built on a foundation of trust and transparency with your investors, with your board. We had a super talented board that kind of, you know, was very diverse, came from kind of all walks of life, and everybody played a bit of a different role. So I really tried to build a board where everybody kind of brought their own unique contribution to the board that was different but complementary. So I think it's one-to-one trusting relationships. I think it's getting the team to gel as a group. And then ultimately, I think the board looks to the CEO if they've got the data, the confidence, and the conviction to make a move.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I mean, trust is an asset that accrues every day or gets depleted, and it's built by transparency and accountability, right? Like your point earlier about the no excuses policy, you build that over multiple years, and a rational set of investors will value that very highly. So you kind of built the trust, Scott, and it is quite uncomfortable in some ways to stare a recession in the face and take the margin so negative against very strong unit economics, but nonetheless. But that's, I think, where real trust, real accountability, real transparency around the board tables pays off in spades. And I think today in 2022, the CEOs and boards that have invested in that type of communication, that kind of trust, are in a great position to take some big swings. And those that didn't, well, they can't, they shouldn't. And so, you know, hats off to you. Let's get maybe one level deeper and talk about the bets that you made. So break it down into the handful of big bets that you want to take. And let's talk about those for a second.
Sure, Dave. I think they fell into a couple categories. The first would be, let's say, R&D, continue to lean in on innovation. We ended up spending about 20% of revenue on R&D consistently. We really never tapered it. Our CTO, Scott McCorkle, always was very ambitious around more developers, you know, more product leaders, and there's just a lot more functionality to be built. So I think we had a great eye toward product roadmap and adding new capabilities and a real willingness to continue to invest in product and development. So that was one. The second, which we touched on, was just building a lot of sales capacity. And I thought we knew a lot about building sales capacity to exact target. That was really one of our differentiators that created separation in the market. And then fast forward, we get acquired by Salesforce, and I learned even more about creating sales capacity and distribution. And to your point, Dave, it's really interesting as the marketing cloud within Salesforce has now become a multi-billion dollar product line. They've continued to build much more sales capacity than we had, you know, kind of back in the day. So that there's always a high correlation there. And then I'd say third is we really expanded globally. So at that time, we were really very US-centric, very North American-centric. And then we started opening up offices around the world. We acquired several resellers we had in markets like the UK, Australia, and Brazil. And that gave us a global footprint that we could really build from. And fortunately, we had amazing clients like Nike and Expedia and Microsoft that were pushing us to build more of a global footprint. So we weren't doing it in a vacuum. We were actually expanding arm in arm with customers who had those global needs. So that was probably a third lever, I'd say, where we really leaned in pretty aggressively on investment.
Yeah, I loved how you, back to the crafty and clever comment, I loved how you went international. You got some exclusive partners that learned your product, that sold your product, that you knew the people. And then now, did you have a right to buy them back, or what, did you structure that as a one-off deal?
We really didn't, Dave. We kind of went in with the best of intentions that if the partnership flourished and we found product market fit in these new markets, that there'd be a likelihood that we would work to acquire the reseller. But we had no prior commitment, no pre-negotiated price. And you're right, it turned out terrific for the entrepreneurs and was very, very capital efficient way for Exact Target to build that global footprint while kind of reducing cost and risk in those early days.
So maybe shifting to the less obvious but important bets, sales capacity. I think we have a lot of the machinery now that most growth investors can understand, cohorts onboarding and payback. Was there anything specific that you thought you got really right in that? Because it did drive so much of the success of the business.
Yeah, great question, Dave. I think we invested heavily in sales enablement. So onboarding, training was really, really important. We started to add resources like solution consulting and, you know, kind of other roles that help give our sales team more leverage. We always celebrated their successes. And then I'd say we had great rep longevity, which is really interesting, Dave. And I'm working with many early stage companies right now that are experiencing a lot of turnover in their sales organization. And I'm reminded that tenure is a huge predictor of sales productivity. And it makes sense, right? Just the longer you're with the organization, the more customer relationships, stories, confidence, knowing how to reach back into the organization internally and get things done. Those cross-functional relationships are so imperative that there's just a high correlation between tenure and productivity. And you got to work hard on the cultural side to make sure that members of your sales team are succeeding and feeling supported and are hitting their earnings targets. And I think we did a good job in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about product. Incredibly important to invest in the downturn while your competitors aren't, because you leave the bad times with a much stronger value prop, much stronger product. But how do you think about, in a world of scarce resources, how to resource that, how to think about return on investment, and how to manage it internally, manage externally?
Yeah, it was kind of hand in hand with stretching up into the enterprise. Larger, more sophisticated clients were really demanding that we added more automation, more data capabilities, added channels. So we became a true multi-channel platform, added the multilingual and global capabilities. So it just felt like we never ran out of big, important things to build, many of which were informed by being very tight relations with our customers. That was important. I think maybe more than anything, Dave, I think we were just great listeners. You know, we were very good at building relationships, listening, identifying patterns and common themes, and then doing a good job with prioritization of what to build. And that's one of the elements I'm most proud of, is I kind of reflect back on our journey. Even at the time when we became a part of Salesforce, we had a couple of clients that were spending more than $10 million a year with us. And we still had SMBs and nonprofits spending sub 5K with us. That's really hard to do. One platform that could serve the smallest of the small business, but scale all the way up to the sophisticated needs of a global enterprise. We did that with this capability of being able to turn features on and off. So we could really simplify the platform or dial in all the advanced capability. And we kept always tuning pricing to make sure that pricing worked for all those different market segments as well.
That's great. And they obviously, all these bets paid off. The thing that you mentioned earlier that also I think was an important framing is looking on a 3-year time horizon. And I remember the 3-year plan that you put forth was very high level, right? Which is basically revenue, a certain revenue progression, a percentage of email versus non-email, and then US versus international. But you nailed it. I remember you nailed it. You nailed it. So I guess maybe spend a little bit of time on the 3-year plan. What is the right level of detail on the 3-year plan? How do you decide the critical elements of what you draw out in terms of segmentation or otherwise? And then how do you do it in a world where the market's changing?
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that, Dave. It was really interesting. So it was something called Accelerate 2013. And I think we implemented the program in like 2009. So it was a 4-year horizon. But if I had to sum it down to one piece of advice, it was starting with the end in mind. So we spent a lot of time thinking about what do we want our company to look like in 4 years? And getting really specific around revenue, as you said, US versus international, our market position compared to our competitive set, product diversity and revenue diversity across those different product lines. And it's a fabulous exercise, I think, for leadership teams and entrepreneurs to envision what the future looks like and write it out. And then if you kind of start with the end in mind, what it really did for us is it kind of lit a fire around the investments we needed to make now in order to become the company we dreamed of becoming in 3 or 4 years. And so you're right, we were like maybe 2 or 3% of revenue was outside the US. If we want to get to 20, we better get moving on that strategy now. Same thing with building multiple product lines, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, and also building sales capacity. So it really helped us think about that 2 to 3 year investment horizon and where we needed to have a sense of urgency. It's very hard to do that if you're just planning 1 year at a time. So that was a powerful planning tool for us. That's hard to do when you're early in your life as a company, but once you have a little more history and a little more predictability in your business, I think that's a really healthy exercise. And you're right, we not only hit all the targets, we arrived early, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it almost sounds simple in retrospect, right? Execute, build up the asset of trust with your team and your board, lean in when others are leaning out, and then plan on a multi-year horizon. So you invest in the S-curve, the required future S-curves that will fund the next level of growth. You've lived it, so you know it's not that easy. And now that you're the founder of High Alpha and advising companies earlier in their journey, as you reflect on this experience through the financial crisis and thereafter, what are you telling your teams now in 2022?
It's so interesting, Dave. You're right. I'm on the other side of the table now, and it's fascinating. I have a lot of empathy, you know, for entrepreneurs and CEOs that are guiding their companies through really challenging economic times. First of all, I think about like, I'm not a big fan of like one size fits all advice. And I find there's a lot of one size fits all advice out in the market. And I think companies and leadership teams need to be careful not to just think like the masses. You know, there's a level of critical thinking and deep insight into your business to understand whether this is a time to be pulling back or leaning in. The businesses that have such a strong value prop in an economic downturn, they should be leaning in and getting more aggressive. I have one company in my portfolio, Zylo, SaaS management platform that really helps organizations understand their SaaS footprint and manage SaaS expenses. Well, they're highly relevant today. You know, they're kind of having their moment and they're actually growing faster than they ever have in company history. That's a good example of understanding unit economics, your value prop, and when you should be dialing up investment and getting more aggressive. Many companies are not in that category and they need to think more critically about extending runway and how difficult it is to raise capital in this market. So I think it's really understanding the strength of your value prop, your unit economics, what trend lines you have in the business, and then build a strategy accordingly. If you have those moments and those data points that show what you're doing in the market is working and might even work better in an economic downturn, it's a phenomenal time to be aggressive when everybody else is pulling back. And what an opportunity to add talent. You know, we're at a place today where the talent availability is shockingly good compared to where we've been over the last 2 or 3 years. And those that can be aggressive can really add some tremendous talent to their organization.
Yeah, that's both wise and inspiring words, Scott. Like, we at Tidemark are super excited about this period. I guess maybe to close on a personal front, you've done a lot. You built this company through the recession. You've now built a very successful investment firm. You've done a lot on the sports side. You've done a lot on the community side. What do you think your legacy will be, Scott, when you decide to hang it up 50 years from now or whatever?
Thanks, Dave. I hope it'll be that I was someone who enjoyed serving others, you know, just supporting, coaching, mentoring, you know, being a helping hand to entrepreneurs and founders. That's really what drives me. And I had so many extraordinary people like you guiding, advising, helping, encouraging me to grow as a leader and grow a breakout company. And it's a joy and a privilege, you know, to be able to kind of pay that forward and do that today under the High Alpha platform. And also say to those entrepreneurs and leaders building companies, you have an incredible opportunity to build a legacy and create a transformative experience for your team, you know, where they building experience, they're learning, they're growing. And ExactTarget, thankfully, was just an incredible springboard for so many remarkable careers. And we had this powerful culture orange that you were a part of, Dave. And like the alumni network is extraordinarily vibrant 10 years beyond the company existing. You know, we still have a Facebook group where there's nonstop posting about where everybody is in their personal and professional lives. So many of our colleagues are still at Salesforce doing extraordinarily well. And then so many of the others have kind of spun out and are now running their own companies or continue to grow professionally. So I'm really proud of just the legacy of ExactTarget. And then Salesforce has been an incredible corporate partner and driving force in Indianapolis. And that makes me proud too. So the tallest building in Indiana is now the Salesforce Tower. Salesforce Marketing Cloud is nearly 3,000 people strong. And it's been really fun to see what we work so hard to build, continue to grow and take on a new life under Salesforce's guidance. And that feels really good as well.
Scott, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom. Thanks for your friendship and all your support. I think your story and the ExactTarget story is super needed right now because I think there's a massive opportunity and everybody's saying cut back. No one's saying think about leaning forward. So really helpful today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Dave. Thank you and best of luck to all those entrepreneurs out there. I know it's a tough market environment, but amazing companies can be built in economic downturns. So in many ways, this is maybe the best time to build an incredible team and talent and build breakout companies. So I wish everyone the best of luck.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you for listening to this Tidemark podcast. You can find other episodes and content on our website, tidemarkcap.com, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.